Oh, yes, the thrill is gone. That's Tracy Chapman and the great B.B. King together on that wonderful song, The Thrill Is Gone. And I thought, in a way, it was a counterpunch to what we experienced last night. Lots of hype, lots of high energy, lots of talking and persuading that everything is just right. In fact, isn't it great to witness a great comeback? You know, it's round two, and people are still talking in terms of a boxing match or a great sport. You know, was there a knockout punch? Was there a great comeback on the part of Barack Obama? And I guess in some ways, yes. He looked pretty good, and from the reaction, people are all excited about it. But for me, you know, the thrill is gone. The thrill wasn't there to begin with. But your thoughts today, we'll talk about the assignment, of course, was to watch this debate. Insofar as they keep calling it a debate, I understand a debate very differently from what people are claiming as a debate. We did talk about the fact that the various journalists' associations had, in fact, submitted questions and issues and suggestions about topics that should be broached in these sparring rounds. To keep the metaphor going of sports and boxing. But so far, nothing has surfaced that the Native Americans wanted asked, the Asians wanted asked, African Americans wanted asked, and the Latinos wanted asked. And this is from the journalists' associations. They just completely shut them out. So this is a shutout. This is a total shutout. People are watching what they believe to be a process of that is part of the process of democracy, whatever that is. You know, the election and is around. 6th of November should come very shortly, and on that day, we should be all riveted on the whole business of protecting this great democracy of ours. Actually, it's a republic that practices a form of politics called democracy. And on that day, we should have great evidence, because people will be turning out like lemmings and pulling the lever for this one and putting the lever for that one. And we would have participated in democracy and made it safe again one more time. But of course, we have different points of view. It is not so much what makes these candidates different from each other, their political or philosophical differences. It is what makes them so much the same. And there is where the conversation ought to go. They're very much the same, terrifyingly so, in particular ways. And in the particular way that I'm referring to is a way in which other interests seem to have them as hostages. They seem to be willing hostages of hidden hands, hidden agendas. And those agendas have to do with big business. Corporate America has both candidates in their pockets. And this is a really troubling thing. It is also troubling when we have a conversation that isn't really a conversation. You know, they're talking about people who they're not including in this conversation. And it is a very interesting sleight of hand how you can be made, as Ralph Ellison said, you know, to be invisible. The invisible people are checking in on this, and we're not there. We just are not part of this conversation. But anyway, enough of what I'm thinking. Let's hear what you're thinking at 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. Now, the assignment last night was to watch this with a very practiced eye and ear. And I want to hear some evidence of your practiced eye and ear, what you picked up, what you noted, and follow through with your thoughts today. 1-888-874-4888. Well, let's take a very fast break, and we'll come back to your calls because we want to maximize the time so we can get your ideas and your considered opinions right after this very short break. This is a critical time in an election process. It is as it's winding down, and the practice is the two leading folks, which of course are from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, it's inevitable that we will have these two candidates, one from each party. And as we head into the stretch, this is their last sales meeting that they're going to be having. They're going to be persuading people about the logic of voting for the respective candidates. So it's all sales. It's a big sales effort. By now, though, most everybody would have an idea. If they're voting, they will be pretty certain as to who they will be voting for. And so there would be very few people at this point who would be undecided. That's basically the science of it. The thinking is most everybody would have an idea of where they're going to go. What they're hoping to do is to stop the hemorrhaging of those people who are in one camp or the other. They don't want you to leave. They want you there. But if they can steal you from somebody else's camp, they want to be able to persuade you to do that as well. They want you to be able to jump camp and come to them. And this is their way of trying to persuade you to do just that. Jerry from Connecticut, you're on the air.
Hi there. I've been watching this stuff. I'm a little, long in the tooth. So you get to see a lot. I've lived overseas, and I tend to see this campaign as a death cult of two factions that basically want to wind down America and destroy everything. And everybody, and they'll give different reasons for it. But when you get right down to it, it's a small group of globalist corporations that basically have destroyed this country. And I'm not talking about corporations in general. I'm just talking about globalist corporations. I've seen this from overseas. So you have a better perspective because you get to talk to the internationalists. People can see it from all sides. And they essentially have given up on America because they don't want the American worker to have a middle class. They want to go back to feudalism. And you can find different angles of this, but it essentially comes down to that. And both parties are sold out to this because they need the money. And if we've only gotten on board with Ross Perot a number of years ago, we might have broken this chain, because they were scared right down to their very core that somebody else could come up. And then everybody got upset because he dropped out and came back. And then I go on the internet and I find a former CIA agent, which is confirmed, who was asked to basically destroy his campaign. And I go through all the things, try to vet this person, find out this guy has a lot of credibility. And, you know, we start to say, well, look, where are we going to go? We can't get a third party. We got these two death cults that basically want to destroy America, and we're the poor victims. So what do you think?
A death cult? My goodness. But,
a death cult on America's future.
You said something that kind of piqued my interest, and that leads me to a discussion about the comfort zone that everybody has in talking about the middle class. Nobody's talking about any other class, or even the upper class or the middle class, and then there is silence. It's like the train, you know, it comes out on cue at 96th Street. You don't see it, you don't hear it after that. I mean, when it goes downtown or before it comes uptown, but on 96th Street, that's the definitive line of demarcation. We don't talk about any other class. We're okay about the middle class, and we're adopting the nomenclature, we're adopting the language about what we ought to be concerned about is the middle class. And how comfortable are you with that, Jerry?
Well, I mean, the middle class is where I was, but I mean, I fast can see them both dissolving it. Whether you're going to give power to globalist corporations that don't have their interest in America, or you give power to, I don't even know what to call them. I like to call them socialists, but I don't really think they're socialists. I think they're really fascists, grading as two factions. Essentially, basically, they're printing the money to destroy the value that every person in the middle class has basically put the wealth of what they have in a stored value. They want to destroy that and then come back with the things they bought when it was worth something, and come back and say, we're going to find that solution by basically bailing you out. You only have to give up everything that you ever worked for, the income that you put into 401ks, IRAs, whatever it was, your property. We're dissolving that, but we'll solve your problem. And that's basically what it comes down to. And when we don't realize that we've been conned 100 years ago with the Federal Reserve, that is not a legal institution. All it is a Ponzi institution that's been charging us interest, and it's a private it's a private monopoly. Essentially, they basically keep the shares within themselves. Morgan Stanley, the Rockefellers, the Chase Manhattans, the Carnegies, etc. They basically have been putting interest on giving us back our own money. I'd like to have that franchise, and that's what they're doing to destroy this country and destroy the middle class. This is the final.
So are you middle class anymore, or are you some other kind of class?
I'm
right
barely
now?
Holding on with my fingers. I'm willing. I'm at this point ready to take my money and leave this country. I mean, I've lived overseas. I know countries that have fought this evil institution, and one of only a couple of countries in the world have done that, and they're holding out, and that's why they go after these few last holdouts that don't want to be part of this banker fascist system that basically takes over. That's why they're going after people like Libya had the highest income in Africa. You had a free education. Yes, he wasn't a nice guy. Hey, look, there are a lot of nice guys out there, but why don't they go after the nice guys that are destroying their countries first, not giving anything to the people, put them on the top of the list? Why are they going after people that want to make Africa free by giving them a gold standard backed by the oil, backed by what Libya was doing. That was dangerous for them. They don't want that. They want to destroy the middle class. Why are they going after Iran? Because they're the only one that basically trades, and they don't want the dollar anymore. It's not because they're making bombs, because if that was the problem, why aren't we going after North Korea? No, because they want to deal with gold, and China is paying them in gold. India is paying them in gold. They don't want to take the worthless dollar that basically will destroy their economy. We gotta really look at the real masters of this world, not the puppets, not Obama, not Romney, not whatever other stupid candidate they bought off before they even get onto the stage. I mean, we're no longer little children. When we were little children, we watched the puppets, and it was nice to watch them. And we don't want, when we wonder why they don't address real issues. I mean, I was screaming, where is the real issue from either one of these characters? No, instead, they dance around this small group of globalist issues that are safe, those package of goods that the globalists said, you can talk about this, but don't talk about destroying the middle class. Don't talk about destroying the dollar. Don't talk about sending jobs overseas for 30 years that has nothing to do with it. Because if the people start to wake up and to take these issues as the real issues, maybe you might have to actually act on those. And that's against our interests. And you know that's not the thing you want me to do.
Thank you very much, Jerry, for your considered opinion today. Thank you so much. Sandra from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Okay, I want to say that my main concern is that before the election came up, I had been doing a lot of research and actually really delving into what each one of the candidates stood for and what they were actually doing, not just what they were saying, but what they were actually doing. And I'm afraid that black people are getting really a bad deal because we are not paying attention to what's going on. We're just looking at Obama because Obama is black and we never had a black president. But Obama is a black man that is just, his color is black, but Obama is still a part of the evil, okay? Obama is still, have been bought out by the money, and what I think is, us as people of faith, people as a community had better learn how to help each other out, because in the days ahead, we're going to need each other. And we don't need any more things to make us divisive with each other, because we are going to need each other, because they both have the same agenda. Obama's daughters and us, he has daughters. His daughters will never have to worry about the things my daughters will have to worry about, okay? So we people of faith and people of goodwill, we had better learn how to stop letting them have us scratching at each other's throats and killing each other over nonsense. Stop looking at Obama just because he's black and look at him as a man, okay, and know that he is also a demon just like the other one is.
All right, okay? Well, Sandra, I got to get you a little bit more specific. I understand where you're going, but you got to prove your point.
Okay, proving my point is I listened today on, I was looking at listening to all the major outlets and listening to the opinion on of the debate, okay? There were so many issues that were not touched on. About our policies in the Middle East, about things that are going on, how he has signed bills to let the banks and things, trillions of dollars get off the hook, when those trillions of dollars could fix up the inner cities, could educate children, could forgive the college loans and things. How he has gone and said that, he's for coal and he's for this and that, but he's for fracking. The same thing that's going, we're going to have problems with that with our water system and all kind of things. So he said what sounded good, and he didn't go into specifics. And if you didn't go and look at his actual, what he has actually has done, the bills that he has actually signed, he's talking out both sides of his mouth because he's saying one thing and doing another.
And right. Sandra, this year, what's going to happen with your vote? What are you doing?
Listen, let me tell you something. I'm just, first of all.
Tell me.
I'm upset that I'm, first of all, seeing a lot of my brothers and sisters, because he's black, living in some kind of that's all they can see is the fact that he's black, but they're not looking at the real agenda. What am I going to do with my vote? I'm not voting, because there's nothing to vote for.
But people would say to you, especially as an African-American woman, so much sacrifice was made
in order for you to vote.
But you're saying, Sandra, you have to have something to vote for.
You better
for.
Believe it. That's what I'm talking about. That's right. Oh, you know what I'm going to do? As an African-American woman coming from the tradition of where I come from, I'm going to get on my knees and I'm going to pray to my God. And that's another thing we have forgotten in our tradition. We talk about a whole lot of other things. Those of me, this is something we used to be had at a church. And we not only used to put in our mental ability, but we mix the spiritual discernment that we got also with the intelligence of our minds. And we have left that component out. Okay? So I'm gonna get on my knees and I'm gonna pray and I'm gonna read my Bible, which all these things that are happening has brought a more resurgence in me getting into my Bible to see that all of these things that are happening and they have already been foretold, and I'm going to ask God to lead me as a human being to show me what I can do, love my neighbor as I love myself, to what I can do in these coming days to help my community and help people know and try to be good to people so that that goodness will come back around to me, because all we have is each other. These men are far away from us, most of us people who are catching hell out here, and they don't have no idea about my struggle. I am not voting for anybody because there's nothing to vote for. They're both two demons.
Well, thank you very much, Sandra, for your very passionate and very considered thoughts today. I really appreciate you calling
in. Well, thank you so very much for allowing me to really say what's on my heart. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate that. And like I said before, let's get back to getting on our knees, people, and praying to God, okay, and using our intellect and our spiritual ability. They go hand in hand. If you got one without the other, then you don't have anything. We are not just a physical man. We also are spiritual inside. So let's not forget that spiritual man that's inside of us.
Thank you, Sandra, for your considered opinions today. Akoben of Brooklyn, you're on the air.
How are you doing? You know, I just listened to the last call, and you asked to give us some specifics, and I thought that was really interesting. I wanted to give a couple. One of them, and the primary one, I believe, is the Fed and debt money, okay, because we don't have money. We have debt as money. And
okay.
The second, I think, that is really important is the GMO thing, how they don't tell us or they don't allow us to know what we're eating. You know, that not labeling our food products. I think that would be a very big and important issue to get in, but I don't think DuPont would like that. Let's talk about
the first one first. You raised this issue about the debt.
Yes.
From what I heard a lot about debt. I mean, they're talking about trillion-dollar debt and the fact that this debt is going to be a generational responsibility for generations to come. People's futures are going to be centered around paying back this debt. So what is it about the debt that you think that the candidates are not telling us?
Well, you know, I don't know how many people realize that in 1970, I believe, too, we were taking off of a standard which actually backed our money with something of substance.
You're talking about the gold standard?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, the only thing necessary is that trading paper between the Treasury and the Fed creates our money. Okay, so that what does that have to do with the person on the street? Nothing. What does it do to the person on the street? Since 1970, I believe, and I'm going to give a low estimate, we've lost about 75% of our value, and that's a very low estimate to the dollar. So every dollar that was a dollar is now a quarter. And as I said, that's a very low estimate. It should be more like 90.
But are you suggesting, though, Akoben, that both candidates or either of the candidates, they're not telling us what we need to know about the debt? And what is it that we need to know about the debt?
Well, what we really need to know about the debt is that is the reason for all the prices going up. That because we're not using things of substance, right, that they can continue to produce. Anytime you produce something, overproduce something, its value is less. Because if I have apple trees in my backyard, I'm not going to use apples as money. Everybody has apple trees in their backyard. You're not going to use apples as money, okay? So what I'm saying is that it has to have some value. And right now, the more we have currency that doesn't have value, okay, the more we have to pay out. And that's not what they're telling people, right? They're telling people, I don't know what people believe, you know, about the situation that's going on. But it seems as though, as you know, that they're in a fog, that they don't realize that, you know, like they only seem to be able to think 4 years. You know?
But what do you believe? Let's get to what you believe about this debt question. What do you believe is the consequence of the situation that you are pointing out now? What do you believe it to be?
The consequence from where I stand and from what I believe is systemic failure. I don't believe this can go on indefinitely.
Okay.
And I think that the people need to understand that. And if they don't understand that, we're just going to go on this. We're not going to go on this merry-go-round forever, okay? If you're over 50, you should be able to see the devaluation of the money and the decline in your standard of living.
How do you, as a voter, what impact do you have? You have an idea about this, and you're not the only one. There are a lot of people talking about this very thing, that the inability or the lack of capacity of people to force the government to do something. And the response by government is, yes, we have to do something. And the thing that they would do is bring the hammer down on programs that are desperately needed to support a decent quality of life for the vast majority of people. So how do you resolve the two issues, the two mandates? On the one hand, to bring the debt down and to bring spending generally within a ballpark of some kind of logic. And number two, the typical response is, which will be, we will bring the spending down, but understand we got to make some cuts. This is what is bringing people in the streets in Spain and in Greece and in other places. Are you prepared for that kind of a reaction and consequence?
I am prepared for them to cut the military the military budget, all right, to the point where people can live, all right? I believe that most of the finances of the country are going to basically to prop up the dollar. And in order for that to be done, more money has to be manufactured and put out there, okay? Or we have to buy bonds, or we have to borrow money, you know? And as I said, it's unsustainable. So now you're saying, but what you're saying is, what would I propose?
Where would the hammer fall, Ackerman?
The hammer would fall squarely on the military. Now, and when I say that, I'm not talking about military personnel, because you see, when people say the hammer fall on the military, you think military. Oh, what? We can't get rid of all our military personnel. That's not a problem. The problem is the expenditures that they make on military hardware, not people. All right, so I'm not cutting people, but I would cut hardware, and I believe that, just that. All right, I don't understand this thing where they say that we have to defend, as for an instance, we have to defend Israel. We have to defend Israel, but nobody gives me a reason why we have to defend Israel. I mean, I'm not against it, but I'd like to know what's going on, you know? They can't make peace with the people that they moved in with, right? Because the people were there. So they moved in with the people, and they can't make peace with them. So we have to, we have to do something. I don't understand that. Cut that budget. Okay.
Ackerman, thank you for your contribution today. I'm delighted that you were able to do so.
Thank you
so much. All right, we'll take a little break and hear about other programs right here on PRN.FM. That gives you some extra time to call 1-888-874-4888 to chime in on this discussion. Thrill is gone. Gone away. Yes, it is. That's what we're hearing a lot. We're hearing a lot that the thrill is gone. But, of course, we know. I mean, let's be realistic. There are a lot of, the vast majority of people are in the frenzy of the moment. They like what they're hearing. They feel a certain sense of security about these debates as giving them more information and more ammunition to participate. We do know, of course, there are people like you and me who have an entirely different point of view. And at some point, I think the questions will become more and more important to be raised in a mass way, because this can't possibly be it. This just can't possibly be the way that, quote, democracy is exercised. 1-888-874-4888 is the number to call and participate in this discussion. There are fundamental problems with the way things are done. And this is at the crux of it, because this is what defines the United States as a democracy, as they like to say. I keep reminding folks, democracy is not what we live in. We live in a republic. Democracy is the process, the governmental process that governs life here. But it cannot be the case that this charade should continue. And I'm outraged that it, in fact, has continued this time around under the circumstances that we are witnessing. A shutout of people, a blatant and contemptuous process, almost, it's an insult to anybody's intelligence that this is what it is. This is the big deal. People desiring to occupy the most powerful slot in the United States, willing to raise hundreds and of millions. In fact, with the Obama, the Obama campaign has raised in excess of $1 billion to conduct a campaign for this office. So treasured is it, so vital to other interests. There's a lot of campaigning ads, money all over the place, even as they talk about the yawning gap between rich and poor, the fact that for many Americans, the quality of life has just deteriorated to levels that have not been seen since the Great Depression. You have people who are barely clinging to hope because they've been so beaten up by adversity that they could hardly see beyond, you know, a day at a time or a week at a time. This is where most people I know are. Let's talk to Alan, find out what Alan has to say. Alan, you're on the air. Thanks and welcome.
Yes, and I want to thank you for taking my call. I want to make a short U-turn, if you allow me for excuse me, for a couple of seconds. The fellow that you spoke to previously sounded very, very interesting, but he made a statement about Israel, and I would just like to say that you could say positive things about people and countries and the world, and you could say negative things. And I think that it's come to a time, I know it's not on everybody's top 10 things on their agendas, but to look at some of the positive things Israel has done. I know people could focus on the negative, but, you know, there's right and wrong on both sides, but I think Israel has given the world a lot of great things. It's tried to help the world. It's a small country, a little bit bigger than New Jersey. But one fact I would like to bring out is when there was the earthquake in Haiti, they were one of the first responders. When the tsunami of Japan hit, they were one of the first responders. If you look at Israel, the way they're living with agriculture, they've helped the world, especially Africa. Africa and Israel are very cooperative, and I just would like to hear some, you know, less negativity and look at some of the good things that the country has bestowed upon the world.
Okay, and but you said that that was one of the things you wanted to talk about. What else you want to talk about?
I wish Rocky Anderson and Jesse Ventura and Gary Noe and you and everybody else that's associated with the movement, that's the consciousness that's going on, is to get some more PR work done. And I wish, look, I'm 60 years old and I never thought the world would be in the situation that it is today. When I was 15, I thought it would be a wonderful place to live in.
Well, you know, I'm going to come back to the issue of Israel and Ackerman's comments. And what he was saying was that at a time when we have serious questions and discussions about the debt, and the debt being directly related to individual burdens in terms of the imposition of taxes and other kinds of responsibilities to discharge the debt, that we need to take a look, perhaps, at the foreign aid. And Israel, as you know, receives the largest amount of aid, and that has been historically the case since World War II. I commented about it, as a matter of fact, when Benjamin Netanyahu came to New York and behaved in what I consider to be a very ugly manner, imposing himself in the election process, which I interpreted it to be interference, and basically holding a gun to the U.S.'s head and saying, listen, you know, you've got to do what I think is important to be done and see the world the way I see it. And it was not the best way to behave, not as a head of state, and certainly not as the recipient of more than $115 billion in bilateral assistance since World War II. I mean, just in Barack Obama's budget this year, the budget for Israel, this is not counting other departmental assistance, but Obama's 2013 budget request is $3.1 billion in foreign military financing for Israel, $15 million for refugee resettlement, an additional $99.8 million in joint U.S.-Israeli defense costs. And, of course, Israel is the only country that gets its aid up front, and all of it. It does not. It's the only country that enjoys this particular privilege in terms of foreign aid. So I understood Ackerman's comments to be within that context of what are we doing in terms of the financial assistance that we give other countries, when is that an area that we need to cut? Is that an area that we need to look at? And I think that's the context in which he raised the Israeli aid question.
Utrice, I'm totally lost sometimes. You know, maybe Netanyahu, maybe if Golda Meir was prime minister and she was around in these days, maybe things would be different. But I could understand your point, and it's well taken, but maybe my answer would be that maybe it's well worth it supporting the only people that would...
The question, I mean, Alan, here's the issue. I mean, it's not just anti-Israel or anti-anybody. It is that the U.S. foreign policy has been flawed for a long, long time. It has made some very strange decisions and has committed itself to some very strange obligations and responsibilities. The Middle East process...
You know, Teresa, I hate to cut you off, but, like, I'm disgusted with mankind, period. You know, it's like we have one world, and we're destroying it, and people have always been tribal.
Yeah, but still, you gotta find a way out. I mean, you just can't throw up your hands, Alan, and say, heck with it, I'm done. The question really is to you. I mean, you've been on the planet for 60 years. You gotta have something to give us to work with here. What are you offering?
I'm offering, you know that lady that talked about prayer?
Yeah.
You know, it could be very depressing. It could be very depressing. I wish I was in the state of mind to give some solutions, but I think we all know the solutions, and I think I get depressed about the fact of the powers that are in place.
I mean, indulge me.
Just give us one workable idea, Alan.
We've got to have one workable idea from you today. Go.
One workable idea. You see how you got me?
One workable idea. You have one. I'm sure you do. You have at least one workable
Gary
idea.
Gary Null and Jesse Ventura and Rocky Anderson and you and people like you should just get a... We're running for president. We're running for president. I even hate the word president. There should be a council of world affairs to look at this world as one world and one earth, and we all got to live together, and there is a lot of people in the world, but we're running out of resources, and it should be a resource-based world, and it could be a beautiful place. I sometimes think about, you know, Star Trek. This is going to be far-fetched, but there was a movie, a Star Trek movie, where they had to come back to Earth to get a whale. Because I'm getting out of it, but it's one world, and we could, you know, it's like, is it possible that it's too late to turn anything around? I mean,
I don't think it's ever too late. I think it, you know, people have to hold on to the idea that people, it is in within the capacity of human beings. Not just, of course, to create the problems, but also to find a way out. And I think
and the
time and again,
is there. And
we
I
have
can't
that.
Understand, like, these DuPonts and these Monsantos and these bankers and these, I just, you know, enough. And if you do speak out, you know, Gary talks about phones being tapped and computers. And it's really, we're really at a high point of, you know, the hammer falling down.
Well, Alan, I wish you could call again after you've had a chance to figure out, too, what your contribution would be in the way of solutions. But I thank you very much for calling today. Jeff from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice.
Hello.
I'd like to offer a few workable suggestions, although they'll be difficult to implement. Regarding the debt, I think I'd like to piggyback a little, I believe, on what Akhbar said, but I think we should cut the military spending. I think we should just cut the aid to Israel, not only because of the $3.1 billion that you mentioned, but because we're also making millions and hundreds of millions of enemies worldwide with our support for Israel. And I say that as one who's been to the West Bank and Gaza as a guest of the Palestinians, and I've seen what goes on there. So I know how inaccurate much of the presentation we're fed here. And a third thing, and most important in terms of dealing with the debt, is I think we need very, very definitely need progressive taxation. We have to really tax the rich, and I think we'd be able to handle that. Now, in terms of what should be done with the money as we start saving it, I think we need a massive federal jobs program. This crisis, to me, is deepening, and it's going to deepen. I have a 22-year-old daughter, and her generation is facing all kinds of problems, and it is also shaped very much in a white supremacist fashion. Are you there, Utrecht?
Yes, I'm listening.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm riveted. Yeah.
It's shaped in a white supremacist fashion. So when I say we need federal jobs, but not like was done in the New Deal. Sometimes people say, oh, we need a program like FDR's, but that program was very much shaped in a white supremacist fashion because he had ties to get his programs passed to the Dixiecrats. And one of the most startling statistics, well, I'll cite a few, but one startling statistic is at the start of the Depression, when the gap was wide, as it is now between rich and poor back in 1929, gap was extremely wide, and we move into the Great Depression, but the black-to-white unemployment ratio at the start of the Depression was roughly 1-to-1, which is shocking to people who've grown up, as I have, you know, in these recent years, because all we've ever known is a 2-to-1 black-to-white unemployment ratio. But it was 1-to-1, and when you think about it, it makes sense because black people were brought to this country to do work, right? And but those programs, all the CCC and all those federal programs were shaped in a white supremacist fashion, and that's when you see so much of the gap widening, because in order to maintain control, social control, actually, in this society, part of the response was to start shaping the response in white supremacist fashion. Other things that people are not aware of, but most people anyway, from my experience, even some of the massive safety net, things like Social Security and the labor legislation, when they're initially set up, they exclude domestic and agricultural workers, which was 70-80% of your black and Latin workforce. The change in Social Security doesn't come till 1951. Another thing, another product of this whole effort, of this FDR New Deal, and there are people who write about this. A fellow named Katz Nelson at Columbia writes a book, When Affirmative Action Was White, and he describes how each and every program and policy of the New Deal was shaped in a white supremacist fashion. Another example, I live in New Jersey, but one of the glaring examples is the GI Bill. The statistics for the GI Bill, under the GI Bill, you can get a home with zero down payment on your loan and low interest mortgage rates. Statistics for New York, New Jersey area, GI loans, 70,000 GI loans, less than 100 go to families of color. That's how you get these all-white suburbs in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And it's not only New York, of course, that's what happens all over the country. So what I think is, you know, in terms of, I mentioned some of the ways to start adjusting that budget, you know, particularly taxing the rich, cutting back the military, cutting back the aid to Israel, but then every issue that we look at domestically, particularly, we have to look at how is white supremacy shaping that issue. And then we have to develop our plans and programs to address that. So if it's going to be a jobs program, we have to make sure that it's one that is going to have affirmative action built into it. I have a great wariness of all this talk about the small business area being the key. I don't think so. I think we need the federal jobs program because small businesses, two things. One, they are predominantly not people of, particularly not blacks and Latins, right? And two, that's one area where there is less monitoring, federal monitoring on discrimination, right? Because there are laws that you say, you know, who's excluded and who's not. So they are some of my suggestions. I have one other suggestion, if I may, and this
well,
is
we're kind of close on time, so
okay.
you have
here's
to
my last one. You think about this one. I would like to suggest, in passing, you mentioned refugee aid. I would like to suggest that, and you really want to get some people who know the area, that you do a serious program look at the Lautenberg Amendment on Immigration. This was put forward by Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, 1988. It's been re-upped every year. It's going to open your eyes and those of all your listeners.
Well, thank you very much for that. You mentioned affirmative action. That's going to be our topic on Friday with an extraordinary guest walking us through some of the labyrinths of affirmative action policies. But thank you all. Thank you so much for making this a very informative hour. That's the whole point. This program is about to get you talking to each other and putting some ideas out there for us to consider. I thank you for the honor of your thoughts, and I certainly cherish them. Tune in tomorrow. Coming up next is Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. We'll see each other again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you so much. I am delighted to have been in your company today.